So please make yourselves comfortable. If you'd like to move your cushion around to see better, you're welcome to do that as well. So I thought I would start by reading a very concise and brilliant chapter I wrote on Shikantaza. Unfortunately, I haven't written it, so I think I'll ramble instead. But I wanted to start with some words by Obata Sensei. Obata Sensei is a Soto abbot, and I don't know that much about him, but he's an essay by him is in a book called The Tiger's Cave. And it's an essay on the Heart Sutra. And as we were chanting this afternoon, the wonderful Song of Enlightenment, and singing about a kind of absolute place, about this enlightenment, a kind of samadhi, a place where we can go where nothing gets in our way, there's an equanimity that we were singing about. And there's something wonderful about embodying that part of the Dharma. And although none of us stay there, all of us have glimpses of that. Glimpses when it's quite clear, when there's no problem. Suddenly you know there never was any problem and never will be any problem. And that lasts for a couple seconds, maybe. And then we dive back into our life. Obata Sensei is in some ways singing about this, singing about a kind of enlightenment that is not separate. So he says, however I resolve not to be greedy, my greediness appears. However I resolve not to be angry, my anger rises. Our human life is such that however we resolve not to weep over things, we come to the state of weeping. We can't finish with this life. The spirit of Mahayana is to find the truth in each step of it, in anger itself to see emptiness, in the very complainings over our lot to know the profound Prajnaparamita. The Heart Sutra teaches us the method of training by which we can see emptiness in each one of the steps, which, whatever our attitude toward life, we are being forced to make. At present, we keep doing the same things over and over again, in the endless round of mundane good and bad built up upon ego illusion. We may happen to do good, we may happen to do evil. People will say, how could such a great man do something so strange? How could such a man do something so wrong? This is all part of the round. Step by step, retreading the same paths, impelled by the deep-rooted karma, such is our life. The spirit of Mahayana Buddhism is to discover life's real meaning. Against our will, anger rises. To discover in the very midst of it the world of light is the meaning of the phrase, passions are the bodhi. Profundity means to penetrate to the real form under the illusion, the truth in all the lies. When the character of the true self is realized, this is the knowledge of ultimate emptiness. He goes on to relate the story of, most of the time he travels, and so when he gives a talk for a congregation, he says that he's able to enter into this space where he becomes a bodhisattva. He empties himself and there's just the teaching, and people respond as bodhisattvas. He said, but then I travel back to my monastery, and I send a postcard asking for someone to meet me at the station. And he says, I arrive at the station and no one is there. And in my heart, anger arises. And he says, where is the bodhisattva then? Where is the wise one who was giving the talk? And his quite honest humbleness in this experience of being human, to me, is such a model for how we can engage on this path that is, on one hand, truly earth-shattering, self-shattering, leading to experiences, glimpses that come, and all of us, when these wonderful moments come, we smile, we feel light, we think, ah, this is why I'm here. And then when it disappears, all of us then think, what did I do wrong? So I want to talk a little bit about Shikantaza as being with life, being with our life as it is. We sing in Tori Zenji's Vow, the wonderful opening lines of that. When I look deeply into the real form of the universe, everything reveals the mysterious truth of the Tathagata. This truth never fails. In every moment and every place, things can't help but shine with this light. So as we're walking along the lake this afternoon, doing our walking meditation, and the light sparkles on the water, and the wind is nice, and our legs aren't hurting, we can think, yes, oh, this Zen is good. You know, I really get that. And then we come back to the Zendo, and we sit down, and our knees start aching right away, and we imagine there is some other place we should be. So I've been at this quite a while, and still, as I sit, again and again comes the imagining that it should be different. Right? So should be, have more concentration. Right? Should penetrate the koan quicker. And I think many of us harbor a secret fantasy of deficiency. That as if we were especially deficient, because I know this is one that comes to me pretty much. I can guarantee it on a long retreat, that sooner or later this ceases to be an interesting an idea and becomes the absolute truth, where I am just convinced, totally convinced with every fiber of my being, that this is wrong, that I am wrong. That if only I could do it right. So there we are. Shikantaza, sitting with what is self meeting self. So big self, awareness, meeting little self in the form of whatever. The content, again and again we hear, everything is transient, all the content. All of the insight you achieve, all of the suffering, all of the pleasure, all of the whole thing comes and goes. And we see that. And of course we like it when it's the bad stuff that goes. Oh, finally my knees aren't hurting. You know? But when the other stuff goes, it's like, oh, you know, I'm lost. So Shikantaza is, as best we can, turning toward the content of this moment as the true way itself. Of course, our primary delusion is that we imagine we are lacking something. You know, and the story of Dogen is he went to China because he'd heard this teaching that we are already enlightened. And he said, if we're already enlightened, how come I feel like this? You know, how come my experience of life is like this is when we are enlightened? So in some ways, this is the koan for us all. So again and again, we hear this Buddha nature pervades the whole universe. You know, huh? You know, this is actually, it's such a radical teaching that things as they are the enlightened way. You know, it's wonderful to talk about it and read about it, And yet here in the Zendo, nice ideas are not very comforting. You may have noticed that all of the things you've read and all of the things you knew yesterday can't save you today. Everything self-destructs. Everything self-destructs. I came across a quote from Corinthians the other day, and it's 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and it says, "All things will pass away and are being passed away, and behold, all things become new." All things will pass away and are being passed away, and behold, all things become new. So this practice of shikantaza is a practice of participating with our life. So many different ways to think about this, and when we talk about Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, so Dharma we often translate as the teaching. And from one perspective, that's these wonderful teachings, the koans, the writings that have been handed down. From another perspective, the Dharma is actually the content of our life. The teaching that we need is the teaching that is here in this moment. One teacher said, the universe is kindly bent towards us. And Dogen said, the walls and the floor and the fans are preaching, proclaiming enlightenment. So we exist in this world of enlightenment, this world of already woken up. And we imagine that we're separate. And all of us suffer greatly in those moments when we separate. So Obore-sensei, I can only assume that like most Japanese priests, he trained from the time he was a small boy, did intense training, has devoted his whole life to this. And yet he says when he's not met at the train station, the heart clenches. And his teaching is that in the midst of this, we can't finish with this life. The spirit of Mahayana is to find the truth in each step of it, in the anger itself to see emptiness, in the very complainings over our lot, to know the profound Prajnaparamita. This is indeed difficult work to do, because all of us have these states that when they come up, that we're sure that this couldn't be it. I would bet my bottom dollar, when at least some places I go into, that this, again, it's this is wrong. This couldn't be it. So this practice of shikantaza is, how do we abide in the place that couldn't be it? How do we keep our heart open when all of our thinking, all of our training, all of us in some ways is saying, this is wrong. So one of the ways we do this is through our posture. In shikantaza, one of the things that has been so important for me and as I work with people is this amazing posture, this pose of Zen. And it's not even so much the, you know, sitting cross-legged or full lotus or half lotus, as it really is the pelvis and the spine. So one teacher says, butt back and belly forward. So that we sit, and the teaching is the bottom half of the posture goes down. So whether it's in a chair or on a cushion, there's a sense of rootedness here. Down into the earth, supported by the earth. And then the upper part of the posture rises up as if there was a string tied to the back of your head and a hot air balloon going up. And this posture is not arbitrary. This posture is, in some ways, we might say, an expression of our enlightenment. So this is the way of being human. And so as we sit in this posture, we are both expressing our enlightenment, and we are expressing the path toward enlightenment. So there is some wisdom in this, and it is totally idiosyncratic. So each one of us, when we sit in the Zendo, expresses who we are. Of course, we're all expressing who we are all the time. In a sense, we're all giving ourselves away. In everything we do, our whole self is revealed. Only most of the time we pretend that, oh, you know, no one else really knows this, and there's this inside and outside. As that drops away, we can begin to see for ourselves that everyone comes forth perfectly. So as we encounter you in the Doksan room, one of the things is that we are playing these roles. So we were commenting before we came in here that so we're out there sitting there in the waiting room, and then we come in and we wear the robes, and we're all playing together. So on one hand, yes, there is some experience and wisdom and walking down this path that we have done. And on the other hand, we are all meeting on a totally equal footing. We are all human beings here doing the very best we can. And we are all human beings that fail miserably sometime. All of us do. And other times are quite brilliant. So in the meeting room, we both show up fully. And the work we do is the same work you do. I bring my whole self to to meet you. And of course, we both meet ourselves. I meet myself in the form of you. You meet yourself in the form of me. The privilege of the teacher's cushion is that it is so clear that each one of you shines with your own light. Even in the midst of trying to make yourself wrong, even in the midst of the fantasy of deficiency, in the midst of the lie you are telling yourself, in the midst of the lie I tell myself, this too is part of it. So there's a quality of this shikantaza and of this practice that I think it's Joko Beck talks about a bigger container. So opening our arms wider and wider to hold even that which seems unacceptable. So this shikantaza, the posture, very important to be here. The danger in shikantaza is that it gets sort of wobbly, and it can get very close to daydreaming. Oh, there's the dog in the distance, and I wonder what's for dinner. So there's something nice about that. As I do that, I think, but that's also not exactly what we're doing here. Yeah, right. Yes, that is what we're doing here. Yes, of course. So on one hand, when we're in the daydreaming state, how to be the Buddha of daydreaming? How to even the Buddha who's doing it wrong, to participate in that. And of course, as we notice that we're wandering, to come back. I was talking with one of you about the importance of the intention behind the sitting. And I notice it especially in shikantaza. It's a little bit like an improvisational dance. That when you're out doing an improvisational dance and you get lost, you've got nothing. You know, you're out there on stage like, oh, because there are no steps. Shikantaz is a little bit like that. When it breaks down, there's like, what do you hold on to? And that's why I really emphasize posture and being in the body trusting the body, trusting the sensation, being with whatever arises. And so with the body is the breath. So one way to think about shikantaz is synchronizing body, breath, and mind. So bringing our whole self to this experience. So through this awareness of body and breath, we can create some stability, some sense of presence. And then, of course, out of this, we might even say it's a kind of stopping or kind of even slowing down. And don't imagine that this happens in absolutes. So when we talk about, I remember my teacher used to talk about, you know, so we're on retreat and he'll say, well, now we've all slowed down and entered the stream, and I'm there, well, I haven't. I must be the only one who hasn't. Let's see, everybody else is really, you know. So when you hear this, don't exclude yourself. We all know this, this place of even slowing down just a little bit. And out of that place, of course, something arises. The self arises in the form of wandering mind, in the form of strong sensation, in the form of irritation, too hot, too cold, not enough, too much. Endlessly the mind goes on and on. So from this place of shikantaza, whatever arises, fantasy of deficiency, whatever, we investigate this as best we can. And to investigate, to participate, does not mean to lose yourself in it. So when my despair arises, it's very challenging to be with, because I get a little close to it and then I'm sucked into it. And then I'm totally believing it. So this kind of investigation in shikantaza is participating with meeting, self-meeting self, but if little self takes over, right? If little self takes over, then I'm wandering in the grasses and in delusion, and probably take me a while to come back. So there's some things that are so sticky. Like so one way to think about koan, about your individual koan, the koan of your life, is that place that rises again and again where you get stuck. That belief about yourself that seems so true, that anger that rises no matter what you do, that sadness, that despair. So on one hand, we might think of this as your character flaw. So all of us have areas where we're quite clear and do quite well. And then all of us have these places that are hard to be with. They're foggy. It's even hard to focus on them because we just sort of go away. The teaching of shikantaza is that these very places are the Dharma gates. So this very sense of lack of that, and actually for most of us there's some kind of shame and embarrassment, like I shouldn't have this. This is the part about me that's really broken. And of course most of us would trade that away. You know, there's a certain, for me there's a certain place of deep aloneness and hopelessness I go to, that, you know, comes again and again, and I think I've penetrated it, and there it is again. And so the challenge for me, the challenge for all of us is in those places, especially those places that arise again and again. They arise not because you are a failure, because that's the story that comes up. Well, I've been doing Zen for, 2 months. How come this still comes back? And I just want to tell you, you can run that story for many, many, many years. I've been doing Zen for 30 years. How come this still comes back? It comes back because this is life. This is the deep enlightenment. This is the what Tori Zenji talks about, someone becomes their sworn enemy. Well, of course, we've met the enemy, and he is us. So the enemy shows up, this one who stands in your way, this one who ruins your life. Yeah, there he is again. And you tell him to run, get away, and he doesn't listen. He doesn't behave, doesn't play by the rules. And so Tori Zenji is saying, this is the Buddha's boundless loving kindness. Even to contemplate this, that these worst places, these challenging places, is part of the Buddha's boundless loving kindness. And in another translation of Tori Zenji, he talks about, and in our response to these places, we then are transformed. In our response, as we meet this place, it seems very important to me that we practice with love. That we infuse all of our practice with a spirit of open-heartedness. That one of the dangers of Zen is that it can become very intense, and part of that's out of this deep longing that arises in all of us. Like, we taste it and it's not enough. It's never enough. How do we keep going? And so this determination we're talking about, very important. And this open heart, we might even say it's an aspect of faith. This allowing the possibility that this might be the moment you have been waiting for. This moment. Not the moment after you have pass your next koan, or not the moment after you have your next insight. In the midst of this world, I loved what James, one of the things he was talking about, that sometimes koans are misunderstood as sort of transcendent and breaking through, and how that's just another kind of delusion. I think it's so easy to fall into this duality, and it's so subtle and so pervasive, and again it comes. But the teaching is that, everything is separate, and there is no separation. Yes to continuing to practice, yes to unfolding, and continuing to unfold. But there is no end. My teacher, George Bowman, who has perhaps more than anyone I know devoted his life to practice, not even as much to teaching, but, practice day after day, year of silence, all this stuff. I'm so heartened when I hear him report how miserable his life is sometimes. And not just because I like other people to suffer. But because we all make up some fantasy of how it will be. And the subtlety of the fantasy is endless. And so what George says, his experience is, he says, sometimes the world is so clear you can't imagine it. A world of impossible brightness. And then he said, and the next morning I wake up and find myself crumpled in a heap at the base of the mountain and wonder what I did wrong. And he's saying, and my experience too, is that it's not about doing something wrong. It's about this is birth and death. This is the dynamic nature of life. Whatever we have today, we will be asked to give it away tomorrow. In some ways, Zen does not save us from our life, does not spare us any of the agony. But yet, as we meet that, as we meet the suffering of our life, as we meet our own death, and our own death not in the sense of the physical thing, I mean, that will come soon enough, but the death of what we knew, the death of our understanding, the death of our ease, the death of our deficiency. That's a hard one to let go. Imagine if you weren't deficient and couldn't complain about yourself. What would you do with your time? You know. But this practice of shikantaza is dying over and over again, dying into this moment. So the promise is that as you die, you will be reborn. And I think we all have some experience of that. Some taste of things collapsing, things falling apart, and then something else happens. So, in some ways, shikantaza is participating in our own death, and of course, it's participating in our own life, and allowing this to unfold. This participating is very different than doing. Participating, you don't know, we can't know where it's going. But as we do it, and all of us in this room have some experience of following what is happening, we might even say, leaning back into the arms of the Dharma, and something meets us. So the exact degree to which we let go of our ideas of who we think we are and who we think we should be. We encounter something that's quite trustworthy, something that meets us in a very particular way and that has no fixed form, something we can't hold on to, but something that never leaves us. My encouragement to us all as we go through our changes to consider the possibility that what is presenting itself right in this moment is your true way, your true enlightenment, already here, already done. So Mary Oliver says, the world offers itself to you. Let's all appreciate all of the offering. Thank you. So, questions for Melissa or James? Josh.
Thank you for dedicating this entire talk to my own personal. It's been very confusing for the
rest
of us. After years of therapy,
somewhat understanding of why it is, from a Western psychological perspective, why it is that I'm convinced that I'm inadequate, that I'm a failure, that I can't do what Zen tells me I can do. Could you speak some to why it is that if we are in fact already enlightened, why do we maintain that delusion that, why do I maintain that delusion that I'm not able to? It's a very successful delusion.
So the questioner has done years of therapy and is complaining that it hasn't worked and wants to know why. Well, the first place I go with that is what you say is that it's actually been quite successful. All of us in this room have been quite successful in our neuroses, and I think we should be grateful to the strategies we've created that have allowed us to come to this place. So the teaching of Zen is that these problems, these deficiencies, are actually not what you think they are.
And they are.
Yeah. They are your great enlightenment. So you think, well, you know, why do I have these deficiencies if I'm told I'm perfect? So the broader view is that as we look into these places, again, these stuck places, these deficiencies, there is something that happens. They're very hard to look at because we think we know them. Right, so it comes up. Oh, here it is again. All the, you know, therapy. Okay, I know where it comes from. I can tell the story. All of that keeps us separate. You know, all of that. I don't want to go there because it's terrible there, or I'll die, or it's never going to end, or whatever it is. So the teaching is to bring curiosity to those places. What is there? There in the experience of them you do not yet know. So to really investigate, and sometimes we can only do this from the edge, right? Yeah, you know, we get too close and it's like, whoa. So it's almost like we were talking the other day about peripheral vision. You can just sort of see it even if you turn towards it, you know, what's that mythical figure you can't look at because you die?
Medusa.
Yeah, Medusa. Yeah, we were saying the other day, the burning bush. Medusa or the burning bush, which is it? But to awaken a kind of curiosity, to notice the story about that. The story is actually not the experience. So to be with the experience itself, and the story actually is not very important or helpful or anything in this kind of work. Yeah. Do you guys, Melissa, do you want to? Yeah.
That's what I would have said.
Yeah. Okay.
I think, though, that speaking for myself, it takes an enormous amount of courage or faith to just go on the principle that this is what's unfolding in front of us, that myself, this particular moment, and that's a real bad flower that opened up right there. Mm. And sometimes, to me, the story that accompanies that, to let go of the story or just be present with the story in a way of seems a little fraudulent, maybe, somehow, as though this practice were saying, oh, I can ignore the truth about me, or I can, you know, I don't know quite how to, I mean, there's the visceral experience of mm-hmm. of the sensation affiliated with whatever, and then there's the yada yada yada, the narrative that I've created, and by the way, if I feel this way, then the narrative is going to go that way, and if I listen to the narrative, then this feeling is going to happen. The whole sort of feedback kind of loop is sort of perceived, and somehow to step outside of it, you know, there's a part of me that, you know, occasionally hears a whisper to me, you know what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Like that,
I guess. Melissa, do you
want to?
Another person feels like therapy hasn't worked.
Another person who feels like therapy hasn't worked. Well, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding you. Basically, what I'm hearing is you have these visceral sensations, and you have the yada, yada, yada. And there's a feedback loop, right? And this is just you who this happens to. No, actually, I'm... Yeah. So... Yeah, but not quite as much. Only a little bit. Right. Yeah, not me at all. So that's what you're presenting. And what I'm hearing is that part of the yada, yada, yada is whispering to you, this is true? That's the thing I want to get a little clarity on. There's some problem here. But the narrative is true.
I always feel like, it's very hard, I think you put your finger on it, it's very hard to get close to the really scary places in you.
Yeah.
And sometimes... when you do, the particular truth that is sort of manifesting itself is, for whatever reason, you know, fill in the blanks, we all have our particular flavors, you suck.
Yeah, okay? Yeah.
So, while you're in sort of full posture of attempting to be as possibly open to the body-mind experience as you can, part of that wave that's coming through is that you're trying to escape, because this really is true.
Yeah.
You know?
So here's I'm just tracking on this. Make sure I'm following you, because we're heading into very interesting territory here, in the sense that two things you said. The thing that I nodded at, which got me the microphone, was that this takes a lot of courage to do this work. I think that's absolutely true, and you did say that.
Right.
Yeah. So the courage, which interestingly is about, comes from a root that means heartful, right? It really takes a lot of heartfulness to do this practice, a lot of the capacity to meet our life. So we meet our life, and you're describing two forms of meeting our life. One is this visceral form, and one is the cognitive form. And they absolutely do inform each other. They do. They whip us up, you know, little feeling in the tummy and, oh my God, that means, and then the that means makes us go clutch, and then it's, you know, then we get dragged away.
I'm going to excuse myself and go throw up. No.
Yeah. Thank you. So the questioner has gone to throw up. This is a nice discipline, actually, repeating the question.
And we're doing so.
And we're doing it so hot on. Yeah. People are listening to this. They're going to go, what was happening? I'm never going to a session. So I'm going to suggest something here. Two things. One is that the enterprise that David was speaking about, this enterprise of Shikantaza, is not about letting go of anything. It's not about saying, oh, the story's not true and I'm just going to let it go. That would, I don't think that can happen. No, and I think it's actually impossible. In my own experience, people who say they're letting go, I suspect it. I don't believe them. I think what's happening is they're going into some other fantasy, the fantasy of I've let go and everything's fine, which is similar to the fantasy of being inadequate, in that it's a fantasy. So the visceral thing is really trustworthy. That's really true and happening. So in Shikantaza practice, that becomes our practice for that moment. the little twingy or the huge gut-wrenching thing is what we sit in the presence of. And when the, as we like to call it, the construction business, the self-construction, which is almost always a limiting kind of a thing, it's a self-limiting self-construction, begins its work, that happens in the form of thoughts. It means something about us. It means something about the visceral thing. And what we do in those moments is we recognize that those are thoughts. That's all they are. And as one of my teachers likes to say, a thought and, what is it now, $3.95 will get you a cup of cappuccino. Thoughts are not worth anything. They just endlessly arise, create little boxes that say this is who you are, and then they seem real. The work of Shikantaza is not to make the thoughts go away, because I think that's impossible also, but it's to not believe in them as real, but to believe in this as real, but something that, if we stick with it for a while, we find is not what we thought it was. And I'm using that phrase on purpose. Does that make any sense to you?
No, it makes absolute sense.
Yeah.
Again, I just observed that I think that, one, it takes a lot of courage.
Yes.
And, this retreat last year for me was filled with an enormous amount of anxiety. And I've given a Dharma talk on this, so I'm not telling tales out of school. I was prone to panic attacks, and last year happened for the first time in 10 years. And suddenly I just really thrown for a loop by it. And Melissa convinced me to hang in there with them and watch. She took away my car key.
That's a total construction.
Watch what was happening, but very much to encourage what an observation, close observation, over the process of several days, the whole thing kind of modulated. And then by the time I left the retreat, and I'm not saying that this was necessarily a positive outcome or good or bad or whatever, it was very strange. It was like the ground sealed up. Mm-hmm. And it was very hard in some ways even to get myself to believe in the reality of emotionally what I had experienced 2 days before. Mm-hmm. But David's point that this feels real, absolutely real, is the hard thing, personally speaking, to face in the practice, is the pressure of that this is real.
It's so convincing, and it's there are these constructions, these self-constructions are usually, I think David pointed to this, we're addicted to them. We think that they explain who we are, and without them, as you said, what would we do with our time if we didn't have this? So there's a tendency to, and may we all. I mean, we have a number of days ahead of us. Yeah. So this is such a wonderful point, Kim, and it's important to remember that it's not about letting go of this stuff. It's about actually letting it be, as we say, opening the hand of thought, and letting ourselves be in the presence of these as thoughts, as constructions. And not to say go away, but also not to buy in maybe the way we used to.
Way over in the corner, yeah. Is it Gina?
So I'm going to say the first thing I'm going to say is that Shikin has a pretty quiet practice, quiet mind. I know.
Pardon?
I am a little power.
Yeah.
I can see very, very deep. I can see very deep cushions. And very deep skillful constructions.
Yeah.
For me, I do want to stay in the body. It is endlessly interesting. And that's in your field. I mean, so I just wanted to be
So the question is, I thought that Shikantaza was supposed to be quiet, and yet when I do it, it's quite busy.
Yeah, and what I heard you say is, what you described would actually happen. It's sort of constant throughout experience.
Yeah.
Facing onto
Yeah.
But, I would say that it's just quiet.
James, do you want to?
Well, I think there is an experience of pause, but it's also, but every moment of the experience is the shikantaza. So it's not looking for states of silence, although those arise as well, but also experiencing the thoughts themselves as they arise, not clinging to them. I would also say that we don't cling to the experiences of the body either, but we attend to them. We the mind goes forward, and it's not about indulging our thoughts or our emotions or our aches and pains, but being authentically present each and every moment. That's been my experience in this practice.
Yeah. It's called life, right? And one of the ways, too, Jeannie, I think about it is a kind of dynamic stillness. So there is this sort of container of stillness, and then life happens. So, you know, I love what Jane was saying, that we participate with that. And so the stillness is the stillness when you're just moving, right? So when you're taking a walk and you're just walking, when the more we can enter into the content of the moment, the activity of the moment is the way itself, then still moving is quite different. Well, I talk about the posture, and talk about being with the, you know, body breath, synchronizing body, breath, and mind. I mean, just what I said. It's quite uncharted, you know, in the sense that. I think James said yesterday, and sometimes shikantaza is considered sort of an advanced practice. And actually, that's what I was first taught too. You know, don't try that. And in some ways, it is. But I've also found that you can be with people doing this, and really encourage people, and you work with what comes up.
Yeah. 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 That's.
Your thoughts aren't worth anything. How come some people get paid money to fill books full of shit?
Do you know anybody like that?
Some cool editor gets confused.
Okay.
I wanted to share my experience on, I guess, what Kevin was talking about, and everybody's beliefs is thoughts and feelings, thoughts, continuum. Seems like the first 10 years of practice have been helped a lot with, I guess we could call it depression. Everybody, you know, it's my own story. And my experience is what I did with it. Well, first I would try, just, you know, going back to the koan, and it would just keep coming up. What I learned to do is to taste into it. Basically, okay, the story is there. I'm just going to play it out and just kind of let the story kill me. I play it over and over again. Play out the words. Because the pain basically comes from the resistance to the story. You don't want the story. And all the suffering you think we're going through is still not the story. It's like pushing away. I'm going to try to do this. I'm going to try to come back. So it's just times I would just play out the story. And, you know, all the people in the room were assigned different roles in that story. And I would just play it out over and over again.
So that's what you were doing all those years.
You went right into the story. You let the words be true. You let the
story be true in a way that you were going to face it and not struggle with it, and it would always, it would dissolve and change. And it no longer that is us, no longer bothering us. It just, those moments that always look back on is very strange. It lets the story kill you. And then when you play the story enough, then there's some sensations underneath. And you stay with those sensations and so forth. Until there's no resistance. And then it just burns itself off. So it doesn't help to say it's just thought. It's reality. But just let it be. And that's where courage comes in. And as talked about, basically the time you can only take in therapy a dose of it. Not just as much. So I would just encourage you to just let the story be true. And you'll find out they're not. But if you're pretending that they're not and it's just a thought, before you know that, it's just going to hang around.
Yeah, I really want to underscore this turn. Yeah, this turning towards it. You know, again, and I, like we say, again and again and again. It's so. And there is a quality of burning or being ground up, or these things we do turn away. It's about preserving the identity. So there is something that dies.
And I just get to the point where I don't play that anymore. It says, I can feel the thought, I can feel the spirit, some of the difference. I can feel the body now.
And it
just, it kind of, it, I mean, my experience in fishing when I was with you, I felt my faith. It's nice.
Yeah, there's something about getting out of the protection business. You know, a lot of time we spend in the protecting ourselves from, oh God, I hope this isn't true, or maintaining the sense of who we think we are. I also want to say we've sort of, really gone into the real deep, the nanto koan, we might even say, of self. But this shikantaza, it's a practice. So it doesn't mean like if you do shikantaza, you've got to face your worst fear every moment on the cushion. And in fact, it's actually good to practice with what arises in the moment, which is, the person next to you breathing too loud, or, whatever is there. Most of the time what comes up is quite inane and mundane and runs us. But I think it does go to this place. But I really want to say that there's some skill, there's some something that's built up as you practice doing this, as you practice being with the moment, and we all need to practice with the little stuff to then see what happens. And then there's something that happens as we do it over and over that we begin to be willing to risk more. So, Anne, you've had your...
Well, one of the things that I've heard both of you say in the past, in similar conversations about this kind of thing, about first of all, you listen, David.
I know. Yes,
yes. Not having compassion for yourself in the midst of this practice. And that's been so helpful to me. I know when I'm working with that great Dharma teacher, my mother.
Anyone else have mother issues here?
But that is that the story that's played out. I mean, my mother's dead, but she's very alive and present in who I am. And so when those stories arise, that there's a kind of observing of the story and a compassion both for myself and the other characters. And if you can start observing it, then it's like playing out even though it's painful, it's sort of beloved because it's you.
Yeah, again, I think that compassion, that love is so important on this journey. And it's so easy for us to make ourselves wrong, you know, and to judge. So, yeah, Steve.
I keep hearing that, these stories that we tell ourselves are not really true. And it seems to me that a lot of the time that what makes these stories that I have about myself over and over again so difficult to deal with is that they very much are true, you know, and maybe this is just a fantasy, but my fantasy is that I'm actually quite perceptive when it comes to picking out my own character defects.
Yeah, that is a fantasy.
Yeah, and seeing that the pattern of my life that has been built up over years and years, and
these are real problems. So yours are real problems. No. I think one of the things we're saying is that the experience, and it's my experience too, that there's certain things with me that are wrong, that are real problems. And what I'm suggesting here, and just suggesting it because it's not something you should believe, but as we go into those places, that it is not what you think it is.
I'm actually having a story now about myself that I'm a bad teacher who's very unclear in her teaching, because partly of what Ken said. And I want to emphasize again that it's not that the stories are real or unreal. It's that thoughts have this tendency to aggregate and become structures. And if we try to get rid of them, if we try to let them go, then we're essentially fighting them. But if we let them be, which is what you were pointing to, and I tried to say it, but I don't think I said it as well as you did, to really let them be and let them be in their presence, then they do tend to be seen through. But when they have that energy in them that you're bringing to them now, it's the energy itself that has to be held open. You know, that like there's a lot of strength in the belief here. So this is what we sit with. We sit with the energy of the strength of the belief. We sit with whatever's here. It doesn't make any difference. So now I feel like I've vindicated myself, which is another story, right? So I better give the microphone back.
Okay, yeah. Follow up a little bit on that. It seems to me that part of the problem is that it's not so much whether the story is true or not true. It's that I believe that I am limited to that particular truth, you know, and
yeah.
Like that is the way I am, you
yeah.
know, and then mm-hmm. then it shifts, you know, and the things, you know, I have this experience of things changing over time, and yet I still keep, you know, believing that things are the way that, you know, the way I feel about myself right now is the real truth, you know, and it isn't going to change.
For me, the joy of this practice is that it does dissolve some of that, certainly the certainty of it. We still tell ourselves stories, but we can begin to discern, just because it's a good story, just because it's coherent and round and doesn't mean that it's actually reality. It picks pieces of reality and turns it into this other this thing removed from the real, and the invitation of this practice of not turning away, but not grasping, holding with that open hand, is the possibility to get bigger. To the stories play, but the field is much broader, and get room for more stories, and keep pushing that, and keep getting larger and larger.
Yeah. Let's do two more, and then I think we should probably. Yeah.
Just to say,
Yeah, we agreed that we send everybody out and said that.
But in a way, there's a certain quality that you can bring to those really painful issues. I mean, I've suffered from cancer tests as well, and thank God that history, it would seem, to the point of agoraphobia, and the only thing that broke that was to be so curious about it, that it was even greater than fear. Even if it killed me, I wanted to know what it was that was going on.
So I love that. Even if it killed me, I wanted to know what it was. I mean, we were talking last night about doubt. Someone asked the question about what doubt is. Another aspect of doubt is this kind of curiosity. Being so curious that we're more curious than we are wanting to just preserve.
I also want to make it clear around these particular kinds of states, and in Ken's case in particular, that I actually didn't steal his keys, and in fact encouraged him to call his doctor, that there's another side to this whole thing, which is that when we bring this kind of presence, then we can make better choices about what we do. So we can say, whoa, you know what? I have depression. I'm going to call somebody. Or I have a fever. I'm going to call somebody. Or whatever it is, that sometimes the stories dissolve. And sometimes they actually become descriptions of something that can be worked with skillfully. And in fact, I think that's what happened later, right? It's important to know that this is not about getting in there and being with it and some gutting your way through it. This is really going back to what, you know, this meeting, this attending to, this being present to, allows us to have more information than the stories, those self-limiting stories, will give us. So that's, I said, I don't know if you heard, that's shikantaza, that's bringing curiosity to it. One last question.
Yeah.
First, I've developed the feeling that I'm deaf because I'm a
psychotherapist. some are true. Some stories are true, Bob. So.
Tales, and certainly I've not just been a therapist, I've been a patient, and yeah. I've certainly had my own hard times. But I would wonder in everybody's experience, we really can't be curious about these six stories about ourselves unless we can meet ourselves in another person who can show us that there's something to be curious about.
Right.
It's very difficult. Yeah. To do this in isolation. And that my experience has been that when I've been able to be helpful sometimes, it's by being that person who is curious and interested in the story and it helps someone to see that it's limiting and it's actually kind of small.
Right.
And my sense is that to be able to do this, that's why we need teachers. Mm-hmm. That to do this practice without teachers would be impossible.
Yeah.
Because you can't see the limitation.
Yeah. I think that's really true because these stories rise up as so true that we don't even think they're true, not true, because it's not even a possibility that's the whole world. And I do think it is in that encounter, and that encounter happens in the therapy room. It happens, you know, I coach people the same way we do it in Zen, but there is a coming together. You know, of something, some possibility that arises that wasn't there before. Yeah. So let me just wrap up by saying that I think in some ways in coming together as a Sangha, we do that. So we do it in the meeting room, but we do it all together here to encourage each other and point that to the possibility that there is something more than whatever you imagine, than whatever I imagine. And together we have this incredible commitment to move toward aliveness, to turn toward it with great curiosity, great determination, and great faith. So let's stop there.